Good afternoon. This is Baron Murdoch. Thank you for joining Break of the Bank, episode number 2. Today, we're going to be talking about entrepreneurship. And we're going to talk about entrepreneurship from a couple of different viewpoints, mainly being me having experience working with various entrepreneurs on a consulting basis, having been in the investment business for over 10 years, having worked for firms like Merrill Lynch, Citigroup, Morgan Stanley, having dealt with entrepreneurs with different levels of success, and coming to understand some of the common themes that made them successful, some of the common ways that they acquired whatever skill or knowledge that they had to get in whatever business that they were in, or whatever transferable skills that they had to make the pivot from being in one particular sector to a new sector. Well, I wanted to start off by saying that, you know, if you're employed with a major corporation any place in America, that place is a great place to start because they already have the infrastructure. They already are paying you 40 hours a week, some type of salary or hourly wage. And what they're paying you gives you an opportunity to learn how to sell whatever that is being their good or their service. And then in selling that good or service, you get to understand the intricacies of that particular product or that particular service. Now, that is further enhanced, obviously, if you have a specialized degree, be it an undergrad degree in something, be it engineering or something scientific, or an MBA that gives you kind of like a higher level of way of looking at the finance and a higher understanding of finance because you spend more time understanding it and spending more time with it. Well, being an entrepreneur, it's tough out there. It's tough out there for different groups of people at this time in the market, but it's also good out there for different groups of people at this time in the market. I think the market has had a rude awakening in terms of how sensitive the VC market has become to women in particular. So I think it's a great time for a person who is a woman entrepreneur who wants to get out there and pursue a dream in whatever sector she has a specialized knowledge. So be it sales, be it cosmetics, be it software, be it a particular product. Now is the time to really commit to taking whatever that vision that you have and putting it on paper. And what do I mean by putting it on paper? So whatever vision that you have, you're going to need to create a pitch deck. And with that pitch deck, there are some things that you're going to do that are going to basically separate you from the rest of the crowd who wants to be in that game. A pitch deck has certain elements. The elements of the pitch deck are the first being the problem. What is the customer pain point? What is the thing that people don't like and they need to see something different? The second part of your pitch deck is that solution. What is that solution? What is that value proposition that you're bringing to the table that's going to make someone say, gee, I like the way you approach that. I like the way this product, you know, meets that particular need. What is the use case scenario, to put it in layman's terms, of how do I apply this to my situation? And if you can articulate that in your solution, I think that is a motivating factor for somebody to say, I want to be a buyer. I want to be a part of your team of consumers of that product or service. And then you might have to ask the question, why now? What is the sense of urgency, or what recent trends have taken place that makes someone say, you know, we've been doing this a certain way for so long, and, you know, it's just, the time has just come. I mean, we're just not faxing things anymore. We're no longer using fax machines. Why is that? Because we have email. There's no reason to fax. We have email. We're not in the Stone Ages. I mean, so what is the thing that, you know, technological advances, you have workforces that are working in different places as opposed to one place. You need less people to do more things because of technology, the scalability of technology. Another question that your pitch deck needs to answer is, what is the size of the market? What is the total available market? So that's basically looking at, I have a particular startup that I work with that has a consumer product. And in that market that consumer product is in, it's a $15 billion annual market. So the entrepreneur may ask the question, well, how do I play in this market? What percentage of this market am I going to be able to capture? The next thing in that pitch deck you need to articulate is, who is the competition that you have? Who are the players that are out there doing what it is that you want to do? And then you got to be able to say, what is your differentiator? What is your advantage? What makes you better at this particular selling or creating this product or service than anyone else? What is so special about your product or service? What are the attributes? What are the benefits? What makes it stand out? So you got to get into the product, understanding the product. What kind of form factor is it in? Is it a physical product? Is it a software? What kind of IP do you have? And when you say IP, most people don't necessarily know what IP is. IP is something that a lot of VCs will look at. That is your intellectual property. That is your secret sauce. That is something that makes it more challenging for somebody else to come into the market and take your market share, because they can't necessarily overcome your patent, overcome your know-how. What is going to stop them from dominating the space that you're in? So, and then the next thing that you got to look at when you're looking at your pitch deck, you're going to need to articulate your business model. Your business model, within that, you're going to have your revenue model. You're going to have your pricing. You're going to have the average sale that you have of a particular customer or user. You're going to have a user acquisition cost. You're going to have a lifetime value of that particular customer. And then you're going to have something they call attrition. Attrition is how quickly do you lose a customer, or how often do you lose a customer? How sticky are they? How long will they stay with you? So when I was in the banking and the financial industry, they looked at, how many relationships do you have with a customer? So do you have a checking account, a savings account, a brokerage account, a mortgage? How many reasons do you have to do business and to show up and interact with this particular customer? How many points of revenue generation do you have with a particular customer? Just like a customer or an entrepreneur who may have a particular product that has a SKU or UPC number. The more UPCs that you have, or the more products that you have, that customer coming to your website or coming to your store, buying from you, you have more and more reasons for them to do business with you as opposed to doing business with someone else. And that becomes a strong selling point. And that becomes almost kind of like you can't say it's an annuity, but you have a more predictable flow of revenue because you have consistent customers coming in. You know how much they're spending with you, and you know how much the average customer's spending rate may grow from the time they initially start with you until they choose to adopt more of your products. And you say, maybe they were only spending X amount of dollars with me when they first start out, but now they're spending X times two because they chose two or three more products that they didn't have before. So, you know, you're deepening your relationship and that customer value is going up. So again, we were talking about how your customer user base is basically how they're using your product. Are they adopting your product? Are they willing to use your product? Have you found what they call a product market fit? Meaning where you know who's buying your product, you know why they're buying it, and you know which flavor or version of it that they want when they come to buy it. So another element, the pitch deck has probably about 10 particular elements that we're dealing with. We've covered about seven of them. The last three would be the team. So the team involves basically you as the founder, your management, your board of advisors, your staff or your employees that you're using on a day-to-day basis. And I would say in terms of building out that team, you have to really communicate the message. And messaging always starts from the top down. And you also have to be aware that employees typically do not work as hard as the owner or the founder of a company, but they typically try to mirror the level of enthusiasm that you show for your product or your service. So I would say you want to start with showing absolute confidence that you can create a win in this product or service, and communicating that to the employees and showing them that you appreciate them and the efforts they put in to making your product or service a success. Because employees that feel appreciated, one thing that employees or anyone in general, when people feel appreciated, they go over and beyond. They'll work late. They'll do a little bit more and they'll put in the extra effort. And in terms of entrepreneurship, I think it's the communication. It's the communication of the value of the capital, meaning the money that you're spending to actually produce your product or service, the money that you're spending paying your workforce, and the value of your human capital, the value of those people that you've handpicked. I mean, you've taken the time to sit down and interview. You built relationships with them over a time, over a period of time. You've seen their ability to problem solve and make good decisions. Because at the end of the day, it's not what a person does when you're supervising them. It's what they do when you're not supervising them, which really can either make or break what you're doing as a business owner. So if you're able to have the right kind of people who are able to make the right kind of decisions consistently, that's going to be a win-win for you. There's no other way to look at it. That's definitely a win-win for you. So building that team is always going to be important, and imparting in them the right kind of value system, the right kind of work ethic, and creating an environment where the credit is shared, the wins are shared, and there's understanding in the learning points. When mistakes are made, those are opportunities to learn. And you take that learning and you use that data to hopefully make improvements in whatever processes or systems that you have in place to make your company or your operation run smoother. And that's really the difference between something being a mom pop type business and something scaling to be a real enterprise, a real corporation, is because you create the right type of replicatable systems and processes that not only can you have one version or one branch here, you can have 50 or 60 branches across the country, or you could have, you know, across the world, depending on what the product or service is. If you look at someone like Amazon Web Services, and they have the server farms in different places where they have Amazon Web Services. So they put them in places close to where that customer base is going to have that need, where they need to have cloud storage. So they're far flung all around the world. But I would assure you that they've created a replicatable model, so there's some consistency at every AWS facility anywhere in the world. You're going to see some systematic things that are created, just like if you were to look at a Walmart or McDonald's, any known brand, they create systems to make it where no matter which one you go into, you're going to have a consistency of delivery of the end good, whatever that product or service is. And that is the beauty of creating successful systems and processes. So the other thing on your pitch deck that you need to look at are the financials. You need to look at the product costs, the people costs. Where are you going to house this facility? Are you going to work from home? Your insurance costs, your legal costs, your office supplies. And it basically requires you to sit down and create some Excel spreadsheets and actually identify what are going to be the actual expenses to actually make this thing happen. And in doing that, you're going to get to the main thing that is the biggest thing, the reason for creating this pitch deck. You're going to have an ask. At the end of the day, you're going to figure out, after looking at all of your expenses, after looking at the cost of developing this product, the cost of acquiring the talent, you're going to say, I want to raise a certain amount of money to go to market. And then I'm going to use a certain amount of money that's actually going to help me create sales through some type of marketing effort. And in doing that, what you've done is you've created a roadmap for yourself and for your investors. And usually, initially, your investors are going to be your friends and family. They kind of call that the angel or the seed round of investing. And you're typically in a low revenue generating or zero revenue state. But once you get into the point of you're generating six figures or more a month in revenue, at that point, typically, a VC is more interested in listening to what you have to say, because what you've done is you've proven that you can make a significant amount of revenue on your own with your product. You have a product market fit. And you have a customer base that wants to buy your product on a consistent basis. And they would typically look at that and say, what relationships do I have out here in the world that one could drive you more users, could create more partnerships for you, could reduce your overall cost of goods? How do I make this a profitable investment that could potentially return, take this business, from, you know, whatever it is right now to a $50 or $100 million business? And how do I get to this to the point where, usually in the capital markets, when I was in the investment business, you talk about going public, the company has to get to the point where they're generating at least $100 million in revenue. So that is still a real good goal. Because now you got a serious operation if you're generating $100 million in revenue. And there's a lot of reasons for a lot of people to look at you, if not as an IPO target, you could be an acquisition for a private equity fund or another company that may be in the same sector. So I think for the entrepreneur, from the entrepreneur standpoint, you want to maintain as much ownership of your business as long as you possibly can. And when you do give up ownership or equity, you're going to do it for a strategic reason. But as you do, you want to grow. And the goal is get to the point of revenue generation and sustainability. And basically at that point, you're not a mom and pop business anymore. You got a serious operation. You have a very successful business. And the options for you are many. And that is what I would consider a success. Most VCs, a lot of VCs, if they were to tell you about their portfolio, if they invested in 10 companies in a given year, they expect five of those 10 companies to fail. And as an entrepreneur, I don't think anyone goes out with the intention that they're starting a business to fail. And I think the amount of time and planning, I call it PPE, plan, prepare, and execute. The amount of time you spend planning, preparing, and execute will definitely enhance your success. So I wish you nothing but the best in the holiday season, and thank you for tuning in.